In this programme, we talk to Hamilton M. Staple, PhD. Now, he's an Associate Professor of History at the State University of New York. He sits on various boards, including the Evolutionary Studies boards. He's also the creator of one of the first college-level courses on ancestral living. Now, you might be wondering, why would somebody like that get professionally interested in the paleo diet? And that was a question that intrigued us as well. So we asked him why he became interested and even connected to the paleo movement. And does he, in his professional opinion, think that the paleo movement is going to last or it's just another fad? Let's join Hamilton Staple and Alan in the studio right now.
Good morning, Dr. Staple, and thank you for taking your time away from your busy schedule to be on the Low Carb Paleo Show. I understand you are the associate professor at the New Paltz University in New York. What is your teaching specialty?
First, let me say thanks for having me today. It's a real pleasure to be here. My background is in European history, and I spend most of my time teaching about the development of Europe since the French Revolution. I also have an interest in evolution and human health, and I'm part of the Evolutionary Studies Board at SUNY New Paltz, and I've taught some courses related to evolution and human health as well.
Can you tell us how you became connected to the paleo movement then?
Sure. This goes back to 2002. At the time, I was living in San Diego, and I'd always been interested in evolution, and I'd always been interested in health and performance. And I happened to come across a book called Health Secrets of the Stone Age. And this really opened my eyes to how evolutionary theory can inform optimal health today. So that started me down the paleo road before I think it was even, you know, sort of labeled paleo per se too much. And over time, I became more and more interested in it. And then in 2011, I presented a paper, a poster actually, at the first Ancestral Health Symposium out in Los Angeles. And that gave me, you know, kind of the formal introduction to the to conferences and talking about ancestral health or evolutionary health. And I've been developing my ideas and my interests since that time.
You and I met at the Paleo Effects 2014 in Austin. And you were presenting a very interesting seminar there, The Road Ahead, Obstacles to Popularizing the Ancestral Health Movement. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm interested in the paleo movement or the ancestral health movement as a social movement. So as a historian, I'm interested in where social movements come from, how they develop, and then ultimately what happens to them. So from a professional academic point of view, I'm interested in the whole paleo thing as what kind of social movement is this? Where is it going? Where are we today? So over the past 2 years, I've been giving a series of talks. And the talk I gave in Austin at Paleo FX 14 was in some ways kind of the final talk about where paleo is headed today. And I see there being three major obstacles for paleo becoming mainstream or for it becoming very popular. So my talk was to look ahead to say, well, look, there's been some amazing growth within the past couple of years, but where is this headed and what might be some of the roadblocks that will need to be overcome?
Can you expand on that and tell us what those three obstacles might be?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think clearly the movement has grown over the past 3, 4, 5 years, and there's some demographic data to back this up. Last year, I ran an online survey of the ancestral health community, and it showed that 85% of participants have joined within the past 3 years. So there are a bunch of people who have joined recently, and that's great. But for me, the question is, are we going to see that growth continue? And as I said a moment ago, I think there are some serious obstacles that need to be overcome. These are big, broad obstacles. And the first one is what I would call cultural obstacles. And this is the fact that Neolithic foods, grains, legume, and dairy, they're deeply woven into the fabric of our culture. And I think people sometimes don't understand, people within the paleo movement, understand how deeply woven these foods are, what kind of cultural significance they have. we have civilization today because of grains, right? Because of these cereal grains. It's what allowed populations, early populations 10,000 years ago to expand, for birth rates to increase, for us to have increasing divisions of labor, accumulation of capital, specialization of employment and labor. So, like, we have civilization today because of the agricultural revolution. And to strip those foods out of our culture, I think, is going to be very difficult to do. And let me just give you one example of the importance of grains in our culture today. And I would give the example of Christianity and the importance of bread within Christianity. Right? So the Lord's Prayer says, "Give us this day our daily bread." So if you start talking about removing bread for a devout Christian, I think this becomes a very difficult and complicated subject. So I think that's a major obstacle there, is cultural obstacles.
So do you think that, of course, there's a lot of excitement, and so typically the younger crowd, or the crowd that is more into exercising and, you know, working hard, maybe the athletes and all these young. So you think that this might be a fad that will go away, or?
Alan, I think that's an excellent question. I don't think that the ancestral health movement is a fad. I think an evolutionary approach to health and medicine is going to continue and grow. The paleo movement as we know it today, perhaps there's some of that has a fad-like quality. You know, just recently, Whole 30, which is a kind of a variation on paleo, has become incredibly popular in the media. And I see the media, you know, was excited about paleo a few years ago, and there's kind of been a decline, and all of a sudden now there's Whole 30. I think this is kind of how our culture works, in terms of what's new, what's hot, what's next, and people gravitate towards that. So maybe, you know, parts of the paleo movement might fade, might be less popular. But in terms of approaching health and nutrition and curing diseases from an evolutionary perspective, I think that part is here to stay.
You know, I'm somewhat new to it. I became aware of it about 3 to 4 years ago. A friend nutritionist kept on telling me about it, and I was in the middle of my gluten-free phase, so I didn't pay too much attention. But then as she explained me more and more what it was about, it just made sense to me to switch from just, you know, gluten-free to paleo, because then I'm taking all grains out of the picture. Because I'm kind of healthy, you know, I don't have any major health issues, or minor for that matter, I didn't see a whole big change in my health per se, but I do feel better. And that's all I can say at this point. What's your opinion on how it affects people's health on the paleo diet?
I think this is another really important question. And it relates to something you said a moment ago about young people or motivated people turning to paleo, getting turned on to paleo. And I think this is a really key part of the whole equation here. And some of the other information that I received from the online survey that I ran last year had to do with why people go paleo. And there's really two kinds of people who go paleo. The first kind of person are those people who are sick and for whom conventional medicine has failed, right? So there's something wrong with them. Maybe they have some kind of metabolic disease. Maybe they're struggling with obesity. There could be maybe they have GI issues or autoimmune issues. Conventional medicine doesn't help them. They're highly motivated because they feel so bad to seek out an alternative, and they seek out paleo because it's effective, right? It helps with a lot of different conditions. So these people are highly motivated. The other group of people that go paleo are those folks who are chasing performance, right? Who are interested in maximizing their physical or mental performance. And these people are also really highly motivated. So what you see is that you see this group of people who are paleo, they tend to be highly motivated. And we have demographic, I'm not just making this up, there's demographic data to support this, right? So they're better educated than national average. They have higher incomes. They tend to be a little bit older, in the late 30s. And so this is not your sort of average group of people, right? They're demographically, it's a very specific group. They tend to be 98% white, right? So there's a there's a kind of a niche here that paleo is tapping into.
Right. So you think there may be a restriction because obviously, I mean, some people are concerned about the cost of the paleo diet because it's so protein heavy. And as you already know, I'm sure, cost of meat and also protein is going up and up. For some people, they just can't afford to eat so much protein.
I agree. I think this is a real issue. So I think that the cost and relative inconvenience of going paleo is another factor, without a doubt, right? So it you can do paleo cheaply, but in general, it's for the reasons you mentioned that it's more expensive to eat a high quality nutrient dense diet, right. And it's also just not as convenient. If you're on the highway and you need to stop, you know, there's going to be a fast food restaurant that's not necessarily going to have you give you paleo offerings. So right. You can do paleo, but it's more expensive and it's not as convenient right now.
Right.
But I would say to circle back to the three main obstacles, and I gave you the first one before, and that was the cultural obstacles. I think the cost and inconvenience is important, but it's not as important as the other two obstacles that I see being out there. And let me give you another one at this point, and that is there's physiological obstacles, right? So there's good evidence to suggest that Neolithic foods are addictive, right? Particularly refined carbohydrates.
Right.
So when we ask people to go paleo, we're asking them to give up the foods in their diet that are most addictive, right? So
right.
It's physiologically difficult to do, and I don't think this is fully appreciated. So the people who are able to break those addictions are the folks who are highly motivated, right? And this leads us back to what I was just talking about in terms of who goes paleo, right? So Neolithic foods, and there's some estimates that 70% of the current American diet, 70% of the caloric intake is either Neolithic or industrial foods, right? So this includes refined oils, refined grains, alcohol, etc. So when we're asking people, the average person to give up 70% of their diet, and the 70% of their diet that's the most addictive, right? That's quite a, we're asking a lot of those people.
Yeah, trust me, I know about it. I'm French, so, good bread, croissants and pastries, that's what I was raised on. But the fact is, you and I know that because of the way agriculture is supported by the government, the cheapest source of energy is grains and refined grains. So I could see how the cost of the paleo diet might slow down the progress.
Yes, I think the cost is definitely an issue. We talked about the inconvenience as well. And I think to touch on this, the final obstacle that I think is out there, I would call these social obstacles or values obstacles. So, today we live, I would say, especially in this country, in an environment of, where people want instant gratification, where people want happiness, right? Happiness now, that they what I would say is, we privilege transitory happiness over true mental and physical flourishing, or what the Greeks called eudaimonia. So people are interested in having fun. People are interested in having it now. People are interested in having it easy. And the paleo movement doesn't line up very well with that. It takes effort. It takes an investment of time. And it's difficult to compete with those foods that give you so much pleasure so quickly. So I think there are social or values obstacles that have to be overcome as well.
I agree with you. What I hope is, I'm seeing that in a couple of headline doctors and MDs, like Dr. Walls, for example, that she had fully adopted the paleo diet, and she recommends it and in her Walls protocol. Do you think that maybe more medicine will sort of move that way?
I sure hope so, because I think an evolutionary approach provides a very important lens or template when it comes to thinking about human health and disease. I think Terry Walls has done some great work, and I know she's not just writing, it's just not her own personal experience and just not the books that she's writing, but she's engaged in research, and scholarship in terms of the implementation of her WALS protocol. So I know that she's currently working on specific studies, and she has a group of patients that she's working with to document how her protocol helps people with MS. And this is the kind of scientific evidence we need. There's some, right? There are probably about a dozen studies right now about paleo showing its effectiveness or what it might be useful for. So we need more of that scientific research to support these ideas. Without that, the mainstream medical community is going to be very slow to embrace this. Without that kind of evidence, it's going to be a difficult road.
Right. As you know, Western medicine nowadays is mostly related to pharmaceuticals, drugs, and surgery, not so much as healing from the inside. But it's, there's this whole alternative medicine side, the functional medicine that's approaching food as medicine. Do you think that might be a way to maybe push paleo in that direction and make it more accessible to people looking for something else than just standard Western medicine?
I think that's a great idea. And I think where paleo gets the most traction is with those integrated physicians, with those functional medicine doctors, those chiropractors, those naturopaths, right? I think those are the people who are open to different approaches, to different alternatives, to being really, really thoughtful and critical, and also basing their practice on specific individuals, the needs of specific individuals, as opposed to just certain blanket protocols. So I think that's where we get a lot of buy-in. And if you go on the Paleo Physicians Network, so online your listeners can search and log and look up the Paleo Physician Network, and this is a list of all the paleo doctors around the country, not just MDs, but also chiropractors and DOs and naturopaths, etc. So, we see a lot of those. We see dentists on there as well, embracing this approach. So I think there's been some greater acceptance within the medical community. But I think we have a ways to go as well.
Yes.
Really, where is the best place for people to get hold of you if they want to find out more about what you're doing specifically?
Sure.
I know you mentioned the Paleo Physicians Network.
As I said before, I'm a professor at SUNY New Paltz, the State University of New York at New Paltz. And I have just a little webpage there, and folks can find my email address, and I'm always glad to hear from people out there. I have a couple of talks that are on YouTube. Mm-hmm. So the first part of my talk, the history of the ancestral health movement and how it's similar to what's come before, can be found on YouTube. I gave that talk in Boston at AHS 12, and I think that's a really fun and interesting talk for people to check out. Mm-hmm. And then I gave a talk about the future of paleo, which was similar to my Paleo FX talk, in Atlanta this past year, back in August of 2013, about the future of paleo. So if folks are interested in hearing more about the different obstacles and also more about the online survey we ran and that demographic data, you can find that talk on YouTube under Ancestral Health Symposium 2013.
Okay. Well, we'll put a link for that under the program in the show notes.
That's great.
Well, thank you again, Professor Staple, for your interesting talk. And this discussion taught me quite a few new things, which will make me think. My brain is overheating right now. But do you have any last words of wisdom you want to share with us?
No, I just wanted to thank you and Mark for inviting me on. I had a great time, and I'm always happy to talk about my research.
Super. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too.